Jazza, the general election, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just want to know, at what point can I be smug about predicting it exactly?
Yeah, I was just reading your Twitter feed, actually, and one of the things that's upset me about this election result is that I knew you'd be very happy that you have been correct for the fourth time in calling elections and referendums. So that was disappointing for me on a personal level.
why can't you just be happy for me?
Well, I've managed to balance it out for us by incorrectly predicting the results four times in a row.
Yeah, it's very nice. So, like, in terms of like the right dishonourable, we shouldn't just all put it on me, even though that would be fantastic. Jimmy has let the side down.
I have let the side down. So a useful way of predicting future elections will be to listen to what Jazza says and ignore what I say.
Basically, oh, that feels so good. You have no idea how great that feels.
It's a rule of thumb. It's kind of upsetting, though, because every single time I've essentially just sided with, like, the polling, and you've kind of gone with your gut instinct on things, and your gut instinct has proved much better than my numbers.
And national polling, yeah.
Yeah. It's really the pollsters to blame for all of this, I think.
So apparently, I was listening to some 538 on this, apparently... Oh, by the way, listener, we have a hung parliament.
If you're listening to this and you haven't heard the election result, that's sad. But
spoiler alert.
So Theresa May went in. Just to recap, Theresa May called a snap election, expecting to gain a supermajority in parliament, and all that she's managed to achieve is to lose enough seats that she no longer has a majority in parliament, and she's having to rely on the Democratic Unionist Party to get some of her legislation through.
We'll talk about the DUP a little bit later.
We will indeed.
Meanwhile, this is going to be fun.
Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn, who everyone thought would like fucking suck, he only sucked a bit.
And destroyed the Labour Party, right? It wasn't just like he'd do poorly. This was going to be the death of Labour.
But he actually managed to gain 30 seats. He still lost the general election, but expectations were so low that it feels as though he won. So that happened. And as I said, Jazza managed to get another election right, which is obviously the main point of all of this.
What was your reaction when the exit poll came in and predicted a hung parliament?
I did think it was quite funny, just because...
Because you love watching the world burn.
To a degree, yeah. I should say, I don't know which way you ended up voting. I actually ended up voting Lib Dems in the end. And I'm in a safe Tory constituency, and the Tory was returned in my constituency, albeit with a substantially... it was much closer than it normally was. I think he was sitting on a 10,000 vote majority before the election, and now it's a bit tighter. I can't remember the exact figures, but Labour did quite well in my constituency, despite it being a leafy London suburb and a very safe Tory seat. In general, I wasn't particularly happy with the Tories' legislative agenda. I back their stance on Brexit. Loosely, so I mean, for me, it was quite a mixed sort of result. But how do you feel about what's happened here, just on a personal level?
Well, so I had to vote by proxy, so my brother voted on my behalf. And the night before, I was like, you know what? Because it was I'd been thinking about the podcast that we had done, and we talked about drawing a willy, and I went, you know what? Vote Lib Dem or draw a penis. The next morning, he was like, I was like, oh, what did you do? How did you vote? What did you do? He was like, drew a massive knob. And I went, oh no, I'm going to have to justify this now. And I was like planning in my head how I was going to be the spoil your ballot person. And like being able to justify it to all of our listeners and all my viewers on YouTube and all of my friends, and I was going through this like journey and had convinced myself that actually this is a really good idea to spoil your ballot. And then he said, "No, I voted Lib Dem for you," and I was like, okay.
"What a troll!"
Yeah, no, that is him to a T.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he, you know, well, considered drawing a penis on your behalf, because, you know, having vaguely heard about the guy, he seems like he would take that option if it was given to him.
No, when it comes down to the wire, he will do what is vaguely sensible. Like voting, I don't think he'd bail out of that. But like on the night when the exit polls came in, I went on a bit of an emotional roller coaster, or a bit of an emotional journey. Well, first of all, I was like, holy shit, this is really good, to holy shit, this is really bad because now we have unstable government. Then to holy shit, this is really good because now the parties are going to have to work together to form a Brexit that is going to be of the consensus of the people. And then realised that the DUP were going to be the ones propping up the Conservative Party, and then thought, oh no, goodbye, rights.
So as I'm sure most of our listeners are already aware, the DUP haven't earned themselves the nicest reputation, particularly in terms of LGBT and abortion rights. They're a party that most people know nothing about, and I have to admit that I knew very little about them before this general election.
It's a little quirk of like devolved politics in Northern Ireland, where the DUP are generally kind of conservative aligned, but they are the Ulster Unionists. They were fighting with the IRA, and also in many ways also being terrorist organisations, which is quite ironic, seeing as Jeremy Corbyn was bashed for being on the side of the IRA for so many years. Now we're working with, now the Conservatives are being forced to work with Unionist terrorists. They are, for example, they're the reason that Northern Ireland is the only place in the United Kingdom where gay marriage isn't legal. They are anti-abortion, another reason that Northern Irish women who seek abortions have to come over the water to the mainland of Great Britain. And they're just they're not the nicest people, let's be fair.
I mean, they're old school reactionaries, old school social conservatives. And it's, I mean, as the terrorist thing is particularly interesting because, as you say, the Corbyn's associations with the IRA and other similarly unpalatable organisations was used against him extensively. And I think it was a good reason not to vote for him. Now Theresa May has gone and done this. So
hypocrisy!
I mean, thankfully I voted Lib Dem at the end, so my conscience is absolutely clean on this particular issue.
So the main thing is that the DUP align very nicely with the Conservatives on Brexit. And seeing as that is the only issue that anybody ever wants to believe is a thing, at least in mainstream media, then that it makes a lot of sense there. But the this is going to cost the Conservative Party an awful lot, not just in terms of politics, but also financially. In the past, under John Major's government, where he had a really tiny majority, he relied on the DUP to carry over a load of votes in a very similar way to what what Theresa May is trying to do this time around. And apparently, as I've heard somebody quote, that each time that the DUP were needed to push over a vote, it cost the Conservative Party £1 billion in investment in Northern Ireland.
Really? Jesus.
Yeah, but that was under John Major, when they didn't need them for every single vote, whereas Theresa May is going to need them for every single vote. She only has 318 MPs. The DUP tip her over the majority line of 326 with their 10 MPs. So she will need them to vote for like everything she wants to pass. So it probably won't be that expensive this time around, but you can expect some lovely new roads in Northern Ireland soon.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what the effective majority is needed in the House of Commons, because obviously you have the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker who don't generally vote, and you have Sinn Féin which don't take their seats in the House of Commons. So I think Theresa May's majority is still not good, even if you're including the DUP, but I think someone said it was in the region of a dozen seats or something like that. But it's sort of quibbling at that point, because it's very, very unstable. Do you think that Theresa May is still going to be Prime Minister by the end of this year? Come on, prediction
Who's going to
man.
step in? I don't think that she can be. She's being described as a caretaker prime minister. I don't really know. It depends how this DUP alliance goes, right? It's not a coalition. We're not allowed to call it a coalition. But it completely depends on the next like few weeks. What I think is very, very interesting. So we have the DUP. Scotland now has 12 Scottish members of Parliament, and Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. For those of you who don't know, she is the amiable kickboxing lesbian leader of the Conservatives. I fucking love her.
She's the fun side of the Tory party.
She is the fun side of the Tory Party, and people are like, "Why is she not running the country?" But she has very much set herself up and set up her stall to be like the Conservative Party in Scotland is going to be voting as a bloc, essentially. And she has 12, the DUP have 10. So they're going to also have, and Rolf Davidson and her Scottish Tories are going to have an awful lot of power in there as well. I was actually very, I was placated by the idea of Ruth Davidson standing up for specifically LGBT rights because of the horrific track record of the DUP, and to have a frontline really important politician talking specifically about queer rights was nice, seeing as we now have people who believe conversion therapy should be a thing running the government. Or not really running the government, but helping the government.
You kind of joked that she would be a good candidate to, run the country as prime minister and lead up the Tory party at the same time. But she's been suggested vaguely as like a potential successor to Theresa May alongside Boris Johnson, obviously. And I don't really think there's very many other plausible candidates.
David
Oh
Davis
yeah.
has been suggested quite a lot, even though like a lot of people have been saying that he wouldn't possibly be able to do it. He's the Brexit secretary because he's the one who suggested calling the election in the first place. Although there's not a lot of that's all like behind closed door stuff. Can you tell me how would it be possible for Ruth Davidson to be a leader and prime minister without having a seat in Westminster?
Does she not have a seat in Westminster?
No, she doesn't have a seat in Westminster.
I wasn't aware of that. I thought she was one of the people. So she actually sits in the Scottish Parliament then.
Yes.
Well,
Let me double check that. Fill some noise, space. And I will try and figure this out.
Well, I guess in the at this point hypothetical situation in which Ruth Davidson
Yeah,
doesn't have.
she's a member of Scottish Parliament. She didn't run as a MP.
Okay, I didn't realise that, but okay, as the situation currently stands, she'd have to get a seat in the House of Commons. But presumably, if there was some sort of leadership election, and there was a feeling in the Tory party that they wanted her to stand, somebody in a safe seat in Westminster would have to stand down and let her replace them. Because there was a suggestion that before Boris Johnson came back to the House of Commons, that somebody would do something similar for him. And eventually he ended up getting Uxbridge, which was quite a safe seat anyway. So effectively that kind of happened to him, even though he didn't end up running for the leadership. But there are kind of ways and means, and I think there aren't actually that many other plausible candidates at the moment. So I think it's readily possible that we could see something like that. The only thing I would say is, even though Theresa May's position is quite bad, there don't seem to be that many plausible alternatives at this point, and it's not entirely obvious if the Tories replacing their leader would make them electorally more appealing, I wouldn't say.
Well, it's hard to, I think it's hard to say that when she ran a campaign that was very much, it was like all of the weight was on her shoulders. Like, this is Theresa May's campaign. Theresa May, strong and stable. Theresa May's team, stable Theresa. She, like, it was her what lost it, as well as that terrible, terrible manifesto. And so that idea of her being kind of like still the best alternative, or at least the best person to be running it into the near future, is kind of it kind of shows the state of the Tory party, because there's been this kind of, everybody managed to come together and have unity after Brexit, and it looked like a pretty united party, especially compared to the Labour side of things. But like, I think this is just kind of thrown up again, like the infighting that happens in that party so much.
I guess so. I think it's also probably true that if it wasn't for the current state of Brexit negotiations starting so soon, Theresa May would already have been ousted, I think. The only thing that's really keeping her in place is the general election fatigue that there is in the UK at this point after the David Cameron and EU referendum debacles, and also the sense that changing up your leadership and the cabinet as well, as would inevitably happen if the Tories change their leader, it just doesn't seem to be that wise when negotiations with the rest of the EU over Brexit begin within the next week. So, the Tories have, or Theresa May more specifically, has really landed the country as a whole, but also the political establishment in a really, really bad situation. Even though before this, after the whole EU referendum thing, it didn't seem like there could be any more chaos in the, among the political classes in the UK. It's just, I think this, even after all the surprise, this still caught a lot of people off guard. I don't think there were many people that were expecting it to go this way, apart from you,
not
obviously.
Me. Yeah. I'm in the US still at the moment, and the pound has, my pound is going considerably, considerably less further than it was like a week ago. And there's also the FTSE had a bit of a shake. The stock market was a bit wobbly. And ironically, the lady who ran on like strong and stable government has buggered shit up for herself. I'm curious. Do you think do you think that there will need to be another election in like 6 months' time? Because this is what has been suggested by a lot of the media elite.
The media elite.
Yes.
I think there is a lot of sense in the idea of a grand coalition, at least for the duration of the Brexit negotiations, and because it is very sensible, it obviously won't happen. and instead, Theresa May will continue to attempt to govern with a minority administration. And I think it's going to cause her an awful lot of problems. I'm a little bit sceptical as to just how ready Labour are to fight another election. There's certainly no appetite on the Tory side of things to fight an election. But even though Jeremy Corbyn came onto the Andrew Marr show on Sunday and said, "I'm ready to fight another election, I think there'll be another election," surely Labour must be, as an organisation, fairly bankrupt at this point. I mean, there's been so many campaigns.
You mean financially?
Yeah, financially. This is the thing that people always say. If there's two elections in quick succession, that tends to favour the Tories because they have deeper pockets. And I know there is the sense in Labour that the momentum, no pun intended, is with them. But at the same time, I do kind of wonder if they're not in danger of hitting some sort of ceiling in terms of support for Corbyn. He did get 40% of the vote, but actually that translated into
against Theresa May's 43%, should say.
Yeah.
It's incredibly close, actually, in terms of the popular vote.
It was, but actually the fact that translated into relatively few seats should be cause of for concern among the Labour Party, because it suggests that even though he's getting a high proportion of the vote, it's clustering in areas that are not necessarily that useful for him in terms of generating seats. Although they won some quite impressive or some surprising seats during the course of the night, they won
Kensington.
Which for non-UK listeners is a very rich borough in London, and is a very, very safe Tory area. Equally, Canterbury, which is in Kent, is another was a safe Tory seat up until election night. What was the since we're talking about specific seats, what was the most surprising seat loss, or which of the major seat losses during the night really caught your attention?
Like Kensington, the last one to declare, is obviously like insane. Like it's mad.
I'm kind
Clegg
of
is now not with us anymore.
yeah, that's a Nick Clegg
He's...
lost his seat in Sheffield Hallam.
Yeah. And he was kind of one, which makes me very, very sad. Like I tweeted about this. He is. He's the reason that I kind of I saw somebody in politics in 2010 that looked and sounded like me. And was passionate about the same things as me, and he's kind of the reason that I got a fire lit on my ass. And doing today, the Commons are going to be worse off without him, and I think it's really sad.
What do you
But he was
think?
kind of like a go on.
Yeah, what do you think the future holds for him? Do you think he'll potentially stick around and try and get back into the Commons, or do you think he's out for good now?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask him, won't I? He could do any number of things. Maybe he'll start an LBC radio show. He used to do that and had a lovely time. Maybe he'll go into the Lords. I'm not sure.
The other thing that happened on the Lib Dem side of things is that Jo Swinson, Ed Davey, and most notably Vince Cable all managed to win back their seats. The Lib Dems went into the election with 9 seats and emerged with 12. Am I right in saying? I haven't got the
13, I think.
13. So they only increased their seats by a small amount, and I actually think their proportion of the vote fell a little bit by 0.3 of a percent or something. But actually, it wasn't that bad a night for them, was it?
It was. I think it was actually quite a good night. It's quite interesting. It's going to be very interesting being a Lib Dem, and having these big beasts back in back in the party in Westminster. People have been suggesting Tim Farron himself only really like clung on to his seat because of the Labour surge, and there has been talk of him quietly stepping down, and then one of these guys kind of running for the leadership again. That will be interesting, because I have my issues with Tim Farron. We've made it very clear on the podcast what my issues are with Tim Farron. And I don't think that the campaign that he ran was particularly good. I think it was very, it was overly simplistic. It branded it around just Brexit, 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 Brexit. And actually, this election ended up not being about that at all. So the future of the Lib Dems is going to be really interesting. The SNP also lost an awful lot of seats. They went from, was it 52 or 53 seats? Yeah, it was 53 seats down to like 30. Help me out.
35, was it in the end?
35. Yeah, 35, 36. Which actually, people have said that this is terrible for them. But it makes perfect sense. They've kind of been shot in the foot by the fact that Nicola Sturgeon started looking and setting the ball rolling for a second independence referendum only like a month before Theresa May called the snap election. And I'm like, well played, Theresa. So that meant that an awful lot of people that just didn't want a second independence referendum in Scotland voted Conservative. And that's where I would argue an awful lot of those Conservative seats came from in Scotland. But I think that in terms of like proportion of the vote, this number of like 36 seats actually looks a lot more in line with what we would expect the SNP to have, kind of like in terms of how many people actually vote for them.
Yeah,
Whereas 2015, they had literally like they got like 52 percent of the vote and got all but three of the MPs.
certainly. Yeah, I mean, one thing I've actually noticed reading back the results is that after the last election, the SNP had 56 seats, but two of their members had to have the whip withdrawn during the course of the 2015 to 2017 Parliament for various scandalous reasons. I mean, one thing that we haven't quite discussed, but it does play into the election results for the Lib Dems and SNP, is that there's been a massive consolidation of the Tory and Labour parties in terms of the proportion of votes that they got. Between the two of them, they got around 82.4% of the votes, which I think is the highest amount since that they managed to achieve since the 1970s. I hope I'm not just making that up. But essentially, one of the major themes of the 2015 election was the diversifying of votes, and some of the smaller parties were coming up, particularly UKIP, which who've totally fallen off the radar in this election, which I'm sure we'll discuss. But
I tweeted earlier, it's like, oh, does anybody remember UKIP? That was fun. And now it's the DUP. I'm not sure which I prefer. Anyway, please go on.
why do you think that people flocked back to the Tories and to Labour? Because I mean, even though this was a bad election for the Tories in terms of the amount of seats they got, they did manage to increase their share of the vote by 5.5%. And they managed to get the second highest number of votes in absolute terms of any party, I think, since the guy who got the most was John Major in one of I think I guess that would be the 92 election. He got the highest number of votes recorded by any single party. But why is it that people are going back to the traditional two?
We're a really divided nation. So the Labour Party was very much like people flock towards the Labour Party because of the fact that the Tories have gone back to being the nasty party. And I think that this narrative of one versus the other, we need to vote Labour to keep the Tories out, we need to vote Conservative to keep the country stable. Those are things that we've seen before in British politics throughout like the 70s specifically. And the 70s were not a great time economically or socially for this country. So it's kind of like that drawing up of this divided nation that we have based along class, based along Brexit, based along age, based along education. And when you feel divided, you kind of like pick one side or the other. There isn't really room for this nuance of the in-between. That's what I think anyway. What do you reckon?
I mean, the weird thing is that even though, as you say, people are divided along Brexit, both Labour and the Tories are actually fairly well aligned in their approach to Brexit. They both want to pull us out of the single market, although there's some nuances to the final relationship between the UK and the EU. That they're both basically hard Brexiteers. Which is something about Corbyn's stance that I think has gone relatively unnoticed by, well, the media for starters, but also the voters. There's a lot's been said about how young people came out and voted for Corbyn and voted for Hope and all of that nice stuff. But I mean, actually, a lot of these people are going to be the people who are the horrendously angry about Brexit. But Labour is a pro-Brexit party, so I think there's an element of cognitive dissonance going on there.
Yeah, because but that, there's that desperation of I need to have my voice heard, and the only anti-Brexit party are the Lib Dems, really.
Well, the
And
SNP, I guess.
yeah, no, like I guess, but like nationwide, and they were like, who can we vote for to stop a soft Brexit? Voting Lib Dem would not have stopped a hard Brexit from Theresa May.
That's true, but I also think that had Labour won this election, we would also be heading towards a hard Brexit scenario. Just because John McDonnell, who's the Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Corbyn's right-hand man, said again, I think it was on the Andrew Marr show, that the Labour Party position is still to withdraw the UK from the single market, or to sever single market access, depending on how you want to phrase it. It's that whole thing doesn't really make a great deal of sense, and actually, the UK wasn't really presented. Despite the centrality of Brexit to our politics generally, during the election, it wasn't the pro-Brexit party versus the anti-Brexit party, and it wasn't even two different parties with different, radically different approaches to Brexit, I don't think. It was two hard Brexit parties, basically. There's actually, it seems to me, more division on the issue of Brexit in the Tories and in Labour than there is between the two front benches of those two parties.
Yeah, I agree. But those were the options that were given. But especially Theresa May, and that, like, that manifesto was an absolute shit show. And Tim,
Timothy and Fiona Hill were the two chiefs of staff, and Nick Timothy was the main architect of the Tory manifesto, or at least the main one who wasn't an actual politician.
Yeah. So they've both had to leave, which is one of the reasons that Theresa May looks particularly weak, because they were very much like her flankers. They were apparently very hard to work with if you were a member of the cabinet. Yeah, but that manifesto that Nick Timothy helped to craft was so divisive. And especially, I want to talk about the youth vote a little bit, because Theresa May offered nothing for young people. There was not a single policy in there that you could argue was aimed at the youth, whereas the Labour manifesto had an awful lot there.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly, because I think the social care policy, which we discussed, which was essentially an argument about who should pay for the cost of social care, and the way the policy worked was that more of the costs were going to be heaped onto the wealth of people with dementia for paying for their social care in the later stages of their lives. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge conservative backlash against this, because the Tory press in particular is very, very fixated on ideas of inheritance and the idea that you work hard your entire life so you can pass something on to your children. And you know, to a degree, Labour actually stuck the boot in with Tories for this, and they criticised them for the so-called dementia tax, as it ended up being labelled. But actually, that's a progressive, pro young people policy, because it puts more of the costs of social care, of healthcare, effectively back onto the baby boomers and back onto the older generations.
But that's something that kind of that isn't really a gift to young people. That's just we're not going to destroy you by having to prop up the boomers when they get old.
I mean, no, I think that is a gift. It's not a tangible gift in the sense of here's free university education for you, but mm-hmm. it is a gift in the sense that the only thing is it's an intangible gift, because you're effectively reducing a very abstract cost. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it isn't a very sexy policy, but it is actually a policy that does have an impact on who's going to bear the burden of paying for mm-hmm. Social care costs as we go forward. And that, you know, that problem still has to be solved, ultimately.
But also, there's the problem. The main and only thing that was really a olive branch out to young people in the Tory manifesto was something that ended up being hugely divisive. That's why the youth vote flocked to Corbyn. Mm. There's also people who are suggesting, I don't know if you have any updates on this, but Ipsos Mori, the pollsters, estimated that they had the youth vote, the 18 to 25s, had gone from 44% in 2015 to over 72%. This time around, which is higher than the wider population. We had a general election turnout of 68, but younger people turned out more than people in the wider population. Have you heard anything more about that?
There's some dispute about that figure. I mean, the 72% figure was something that I saw floated around Twitter, but then I also saw it reported that it was not clear what the source was for that figure. I mean, if you say it was from Ipsos Mori, then that's fair enough, but I don't think we're actually certain at this point how big an impact that the
but it's
had.
It's still certain. Like, Ipsos Mori aren't going to put themselves to a fanciful figure that somebody pulled out of their ass. Like, they have reasons to be thinking that. And even if that is 10 points higher than the actual youth turnout, that is still a huge increase in youth engagement when it comes to actually turning out to the polls. Mm. And that's the reason that Conservatives never, at least this time around, didn't need to give young people an olive branch with a boom, because they were saying that they were going to vote that they were going to turn out and vote on the 8th of June, but they historically don't turn out. We are historically terrible as young people at actually having our voice heard. And that's what I find, that's the biggest takeaway and the biggest positive that I have from this whole election, is the fact that the youth vote can be seen as a voting bloc if we continue to turn out in large numbers. And that's why I would be very positive. That's why I'd be very positive about a second election. Because if we can keep this, pardon the pun, momentum behind the youth vote, as everybody else is getting sick of having an election every year, that could really put a huge amount of weight on young people for once. Like we had a huge say in like 2010 when it came to like giving the Lib Dems an awful lot of votes, but we got burned afterwards because of tuition fees. But that's particularly what I'm looking out for: the possibility of a second election, and the possibility of the youth being the guys that kind of end up deciding.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a good thing if that there is more youth engagement. I don't actually think necessarily that they voted for policies that are hugely in their interest. I mean, I remain sceptical about the actual overall benefits of removing tuition fees. I actually think having tuition fees that are paid in part by the students is a progressive policy, because I think it shifts the costs ultimately onto the people that gain the most benefit from having a degree by, you know, the enhanced earnings they have throughout their careers. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm obviously not in favour of young people voting for bad policies, but it is a good thing that they turn out to vote, in as much as particularly the Tory party is probably going to have to think a little bit harder as to what sort of policies they're going to offer them in the next election, whenever that is. One thing that has also been picked up, and this does kind of relate to the social care policy and the youth vote. How important do you think the traditional press, and I mean the newspapers, were in influencing the outcome of this election?
I mean, the press buggered up, didn't they? There was so much hubris, especially around the print media and the Murdoch media. There's the whole story of like the 92 election, where the Sun what won it, right? Like they, on the day of the election, they printed Kinnock's head inside a light bulb and asked people to turn the lights off. The last person to leave the UK if he became Prime Minister, and did a really similar thing to Corbyn, where they stuck him in the bin and said, "Don't put Britain in the Corbyn." And I'm like, "Yay, puns!" but that's what I found very refreshing, is that they've heard all of this sensationalist, an awful lot of the time, rhetoric. I've got to say it like Leanne Wood does. From the press that have called him a terrorist sympathiser, that have called him a socialist, a Marxist, painted him as evil and as the worst possible thing that could happen. And people looked at that and went, nah. And I find that very refreshing. And I'm like, oh, well done, public.
Possibly. I mean, I think that there's been quite a few ironies in this election, but I actually think, even though some people have interpreted, I mean, there was a BBC segment in which many panelists suggested that the influence of the traditional press, the print media, was waning in this election. In actual fact, you can see it entirely the other way, that the pivotal event of the election was Theresa May's U-turn on the dementia tax. And that was a U-turn that was precipitated by the press being very upset by the policy, because it was going to take away the inheritance of a lot of their readers, who are disproportionately old, disproportionately wealthy.
You make a very good point.
I think in many ways, and you know, this is this. I think this contrasts to the argument that the press always behaves in the interest of their proprietors. There's an argument to be made that the press is ultimately the ones that are responsible for the Tories having failed to gain a majority, because that event, that U-turn before the election had even taken place, was among the most, it was the most embarrassing event probably of any election since the Second World War, or sorry, election campaign since the Second World War. So I think there's an argument to be made, but it probably is, I think it is also true that there are a lot of young people that are not taking and not getting their information from newspapers anymore. They might be getting information from journalists on Twitter who happen to work for traditional newspapers, but the influence of the press in some ways is certainly shifting. It's difficult to say exactly how.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. What I found very exciting about this whole thing was kind of like how much they thought that they were going to be able to swing it, and how much they thought they were going to be able to make sure that Labour got absolutely decimated. And the amount of people that just went, okay, I see what you're saying, but actually I'd rather not have the lady who wants to run through fields of wheat as the thing that she does is naughty. Also, very much so, Theresa May lost this election. She didn't turn up for debates. She was socially awkward. She was a poor candidate to run a personality cult around. Because she's just kind of like a nerdy young lady. That's what I see. Like, especially in that interview that she did, where it was like, what's the naughtiest thing you've ever done? And she says, I ran through fields of wheat.
I do think
she's just a big nerd who's never really rebelled in her life, right?
Yeah, to a degree. But I also think that is it's hard to see what a good answer to that question would be. Imagine that question being put to Boris Johnson, and if he was being honest, he'd probably have to say, oh, well, I suppose that time I fathered a love child with this woman I was having an affair with was quite naughty, as it goes. George Osborne.
I do think that that was quite a sexist question, actually. I don't think you'd ever ask a male politician, what's the naughtiest thing you've ever done? I think there was something unfortunately gendered about that question.
It's possible. I mean, the question was asked by a woman. It was asked by a female journalist.
Doesn't make it unsexist, Jimmy.
That's true. I mean, this is very inferential, a very inferential assertion you've made. So it's hard to see how it'd be disproved. I think it was probably asked of her because she's so dull, really. And as you say, she's quite nerdy. And people, if she had a reputation if she had a sense of humour about her, or at least was just slightly less staid, I think she probably wouldn't have been asked a question like that. I think it was deliberately asked, I'd imagine, because of her existing reputation for being boring, as I said.
It's a fair point. So just to wrap up, what do you think the chances are of, one, her still being PM by the end of the year, and two, us having an election again before the end of the year?
Well, you know how successful I've been with predictions so far.
Yeah, so that's why you're going first. All I do is go on the opposite side of you, and I know I'm going to be right.
Oh, there's quite a lot of power that I've got in my hands then, because whatever I say won't end up happening. I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit sceptical whose interests it really is in to have another election. I'm not really sure that the result would turn out to be much different at this stage. And actually, I think even though the parliament is constituted in such a way that nobody can form a majority government sensibly, I think there's a danger that if we went for another election, the Tories would lose more seats, but Labour would still fail to gain enough, even in partnership with the SNP and Lib Dems, to form a sensible coalition. I don't know. I'm going to abstain from saying, because I think in some ways it's equally likely it could go one way or the other. There's parallels with previous situations with hung parliaments where another election was, where two elections were called during the same year. I think it was either Wilson or Heath that called a second election following one in sort of early summertime, and then they had one in October during the 1970s or something. There's precedent for it, but it also kind of depends how Brexit negotiations are going, and you know, I think it's pretty hard to say. What's your view on it?
I think it's going to be very hard for Theresa May to stay on as Prime Minister past the end of this year. And I think when that happens, depending on who the leader is, I think Boris Johnson would go to an election. I don't think a David Davis would go to an election, but it would depend on who ends up in that power.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, last time a lot of people thought that Boris Johnson was a pretty easy shoo-in for leadership of the Tory party, and then it ended up with Theresa May. So it's one thing I will say is I'm more or less sure that Theresa May won't be leading us into another general election, or she at least won't be leading us into one 5 years from now. I think George Osborne's description, the former Chancellor, of her as a dead woman walking, was pretty apt, I think. The only reason she's in place at the moment is that no plausible strategy has emerged, but I think it's just a matter of time before the Tories find something that they think is more suitable. So,
yeah. Well, dear listener, what do you think? Let us know on Twitter. You can find us at Right Dishonour. You can also leave us a review and tell me how great I am at predicting things. Please do. It's awesome. On iTunes, you can leave us a review. Also, 5 stars, please. 5 stars. Give us 5 stars. Thank you. 5 stars.
We should probably also say that we're going to be taking a bit of a break because Jazza is still out in the States and presumably wants to enjoy his holiday somewhat.
It's not a holiday. I am working out here.
A working holiday. And we'll be back. We'll be back sort of late June, early July, depending on when we can be asked to do this again. Something like that, anyway.
But don't worry, we will very much be back. We will very much be back. And it may even, depending on what shit happens, it may even be sooner.
I mean, if they call another general election next week, then we, you know, we might do something. We'll see about that.
Don't jinx it. Don't please don't jinx it.
Should we finish then?
Yeah. Toodaloo.